Welcome, everybody. My apologies in that I know the venue is a bit warm. We do have a problem with the air conditioning in this room. I think the it's due to the fact that there's construction work that is going on in this building, so the air conditioning is not working. Our apologies for that, but be that as it may, we did open the windows to try and get some air in here. But I just hope that we'll be able to, during this morning session, bear with the heat. There are drinks at the back. Please access water if you need that. But once again, welcome. From the side of the Select Committee on Security and Justice, we are gathered today just to deal with the Cybercrimes Bill. This bill is a very technical and complicated bill, and as a committee, we were taken through this bill. We also held public hearings from various stakeholders on their response to this bill. And in terms of today's session, we expect to get responses from relevant government bodies in terms of the comments that we received on the bill. Before we go into the business of the day, we're going to go through a round of introductions. I'll start with members of the of Parliament. My name is Sheda Sheikh. I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Security and Justice. I'll then hand over to Honorable Ncita.
Good morning. Thanks, Chair. My name is Zugiswa Ncita. I'm the member of the committee from Eastern Cape.
Morning. I'm China Dodovu. I'm from the Northwest.
Morning. I'm Simon Vaela from KZN.
Morning. Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Pindile Mola. I'm a member of the committee and from Mpumalanga Province.
Okay, on this side.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is George Michalakis. I'm a permanent delegate from the...
Good morning. My name is Karin Visser. I'm a delegate from Northwest.
Molweni, goeiemôre. Good morning. Isaac Mbulelo Seleku, Western Cape.
Just from the side of members of this committee, we also have apologies from Honorable Mthethwa, Honorable Goyia, and Honorable Dangle. I'm going to now hand over to, I think we can start with the South African Police Services to introduce who's present. Commissioner?
Yeah, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and good morning, Honorable Members. Our delegation is as follows, Honorable Chair. We have Lieutenant General S.G. Libia, the National Head of the Hawks. We have Major General L. Maxson, Component Head, Commercial Crime Investigation Division, Detective Services. We have Major General D. Moodley, Head, Intelligence Collection Division. We have Major General Ravi, Head Strategic Management. We have Brigadier D.D. Kili, Section Head, Legal Support. We have Brigadier M.S. Van Fran, Operational Legal Support Division. We have Brigadier M.T. Peters, Acting Component Head, Priority Crime Special Investigations, PCI. Brigadier N. Field High, Section Head, Legal Services, DPCI. We have Brigadier L.S. Malahlela, Section Head, Executive Secretariat, Office of the National Commissioner. We have Brigadier V. Naidu, Spokesperson, National Commissioner's Office. We have Colonel K.P. Stain, Parliamentary Liaison Services. This is the delegation, Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. If I can hand over then to the NPA, I'm not sure if they are present.
Chairperson, the person from the NPA is on its way, a bit late, he only came in this morning, he's still looking for parking. It's Advocate Paul Lowe, he will be here.
And then from the Department of Justice?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It's Paul Robertson, Department of Justice, State Law Advisor.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Dingaan Mangena from the Department of Justice, Legislative Development.
Thank you for that. I think given that the NPA or representatives from the NPA are still going to arrive, and as I've indicated earlier, we're going to get responses to comments that we receive from stakeholders from all three bodies. I don't know if we can perhaps then start with the South African Police Services in terms of your responses to comments. We've received the presentation that you prepared for us well in advance as well. So I'm not sure, Commissioner, if you can maybe then take us through your comments in the interim while we await for the NPA. I think following SAS, we'll have the NPA, and then we'll then move on to the Department of Justice. Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, for the opportunity. Just to indicate up front is the fact that the process of the bill is also running concurrently with the development of the cybercrime strategy, a process that was initiated by SAPS, but it also involved broader stakeholders and as well as other international role players. That was just due to respond to the agency or that is needed to provide a solution to cyber attacks where the country is exposed. But our presentation shall be led by Brigadier Van Gran, and with your permission, can I give him the floor? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, National Commissioner and Chairperson, for the trust. Chairperson, honorable members, with presentations about 28 slides, it was originally 52 and was even longer before that time, so we didn't want to come here and waste your time with nitty-gritty. After deliberations with our colleagues in the Department of Justice, we are very clear on what we must do, respond to the matters that relate directly to the SAPS. And that is the content of our slides. So we will only speak about those matters that relate directly to us or affect us, Chairperson and honorable members. Now, by way of introduction, and I'm not going to waste your time, Chairperson and honorable members, with all these definitions and clauses here, but we just try to identify what are the relevant clauses that speak directly to the police service. And if we look at slide 2, I will just highlight some of these because comments came forward on that. We have a proposal, for instance, in terms of Clause 1, the definition of a specifically designated police official. That's our own proposal, a small little tweak change that we want to propose. We have comments received on Clause 24.6 and Clause 26 about the standard operating procedures and directives for the investigation of crimes committed outside South Africa. On slide 3, we have comments received about our extensive powers of search and seizure in terms of Clause 28 and Clause 29, and there are even some references to Clause 30, the so-called oral application for certain powers. We also have received comments on that slide 3 on Clause 32, access to an article involving the commission of a crime without a warrant. Chairperson, if I go too fast, you must please stop or tell me.
We apologize, Chair. We just wanted to, as part of police protocol, wanted to accommodate our minister. Thank you.
Maybe we should just welcome you, Deputy Minister, for honoring our meeting, as technical as it's going to be, but welcome. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you. We move to clause 4. I'm just identifying the sections on which we received comments that speak directly to the police on slide 4. There are a couple of comments on clause 33. Clause 34, those are powers where we can act without a warrant in terms of the law. We also have a little proposal that we want to make about that. And then clause 37 at the bottom of slide 30, or slide 4, is also relevant, relating to a question that we received. If I can take you, Chairperson and Honourable Members, to slide 5, we also identified clause 41, 42 and 43 on that slide, in respect of which we received some comments. On the rest, we have not received any direct comments. On slide 6, we have received some comments on clause 48, foreign requests for assistance to be directed to the point of contact, the structure created by the bill, and clause 52, the structure created by the bill, the designated point of contact. And there might be some side remarks, if I remember correctly, on clause 54. But those are really the relevant issues, just to set the tone. And then the last one on slide 7, clause 55, we've had a number of responses about our capacity to address cybercrime. So that will also be addressed in our presentation. So if you look at slide 7, what we're saying is we limit ourselves to those clauses that impact on us directly, but we have also 4 proposals highlighted in red, which we think is not major, but it's obviously subject to direction. Chairperson and Honourable Members, on slide 8 we identify the respondents on which we received comments. There are 9 of them. We will only respond from respondent number 4 to respondent number 9, First Rand up to Vodacom. The rest of those respondents did not say anything that impact directly on the South African Police Service. So we will limit ourselves to those respondents. The first one is then the First Rand Bank. They refer to clause 34.6, which provides for the National Commissioner or the National Head of the DPCI, in consultation with the NDP, to issue directives which all officials are obliged to comply with in the execution of the functions in terms of the Act, insofar as it relates to investigating offences committed outside of the Republic. The statement that they make is it's unclear what the consequences will be if a SAPS official fails to follow these directives, or if there's monetary loss to a company or a failure to secure a conviction. It is also unclear to them what recourse a company would have due to the negligence of a SAPS official in failing to follow the directives, and the request guidance to be provided. First of all, we say in our environment, the first thing that we look at, there will always be departmental steps involved in terms of our discipline code in the police service. We also say that if anyone failed to comply with what the law tells him to do, the answer is in the cybercrimes bill. In clause 37, the wrongful search, seizure and access by a police official is criminalized. It's an offense and it's not something new. We also have that provision, exactly that wording, in the Criminal Procedure Act. And I think sometimes people forget that we can also commit a criminal offense if we fail to comply with the law. It's not only a disciplinary matter. What we also respond there to, Honorable Chairperson and members, we say that we can also address the failure of such compliance in these directives. We can make it either proactive or reactive, but we can address these issues inside our directives. If I can take you, Honourable Chairperson and members, to the slide 10. First Rand is also concerned about the provision pertaining to the issuing of standard operating procedures, which must be observed by SAPS officials or other agencies authorized to assist with an investigation. They emphasize what the law says at this point in time, that it must be issued within 6 months after commencement of that chapter of the bill. They emphasize that there must be a consultative process, and they say that they support this principle of the SOPs, but it's important that the procedures be clear, practical, effective, and that there are clear consequences for non-compliance, which must be stipulated. And they also propose that these SOPs be rolled out with adequate training. Furthermore, as you can see for yourselves, Honourable Chair and members, that must be clear and practical and supported by rigorous training programs. First of all, what we say about the provision of the law, Clause 26 on the Standard Operating Procedures, it provides for a whole textbook or recipe to address the investigation of cybercrime, which will be done in consultation with not only very senior government officials, but also then public consultation process. And I think it is our very good intention that we do want to consult, because the less risks there are out there, the less need for the police service to come and clear a house. So I think we have a dual responsibility as civil society and the state, and obviously that is also an important factor for us to consult. We also refer to the legal obligation that's created on our Minister of Police in terms of Clause 55, to address this aspect in terms of training and to ensure that there is sufficient human and operational capacity to address cybercrime, and that we not only receive basic training but also specialist training. Once again, this is an aspect that is also linked to all our other strategies in the police. And I remember pertinently the National Commissioner referred to the community policing strategy in terms of which we reach out to communities. And that is also the aim of our cybercrime strategy, is to consult, to reach out, because the less the risk is outside, the less problems we have inside to address it. So we must speak of partnerships and consultation. We also reply, Honourable Chair and members, at the bottom of slide 10, that obviously once these SOPs are finalised, we're going to roll them out vigorously by training and workshops. First Rank continues on slide 11. They are concerned about the broad definitions of access and seize, and also section or clause 28 and clause 32. Those are provisions in terms of which police can act without a warrant. You will see there in the bold that they are concerned about our far-reaching powers without so-called limitation to seize, and there's also no rights provided for a person to object to a search and seizure. Our short and sweet reply to that, Honourable Chair and members, is first of all that there are indeed limitations on police when they act without a warrant, and it's also created in this bill. This bill gives us far less powers when we act without a warrant. So our powers are delimited, and if there's no warrant, as we indicated, there's obviously less powers in terms of this bill. We also state, and the remark was made, the Criminal Procedure Act dates back to 1977, but the majority of those provisions have not been declared unconstitutional, despite the time from where it originated from. But in our normal search and seizure regime, we cannot allow a suspect on the crime scene to stop a search and seizure. And this is that type of objection that we would raise against a request that a suspect or a person who is being investigated should be able to object to a search and seizure. We will be held at ransom, because if you see that you're in trouble, you're just going to object, and what is the outcome of that? Everything must come to a standstill. What we say there is, we don't see this in our normal search and seizure environment. Why should it be different in the online environment? It's just another form of crime, but the principles are still the same. We say that these objections, if those would be supported, may unnecessarily delay our investigations and may even be used by suspects in an effort to evade justice. And what we say is, the Cybercrime Bill did not suspend or repeal the Criminal Procedure Act. We still have that in the background to support our search and seizure regime of whatever articles we are interested in. What we say in a short response, Chairperson and members, Honourable Chair and members, is that if a suspect wishes to raise objections, those should be done in a court of law. And that's the process that we would support, because you can bring an application to court to interdict us. You can apply to have a warrant nullified in court, but not on a crime scene while we're busy conducting our work. Chairperson, Honorable Chair and members, if I can take you to slide 12. First round, continue their submission. They say that there are no rules regarding the execution of warrants. They even refer to an example in the Protection of Personal Information Act that one should look at. And obviously what they said, there should be consistency in terms of the rules. Our response is, in the environment in which we operate, is that numerous court judgments, inclusive of the highest court in this country, the Concord, have laid down rules. And in the time frame of a previous acting national commissioner, we have issued a comprehensive circular under signature of the then acting national commissioner as to how members must go about to execute search and seizure operations, and we even addressed cyber to an extent in there, thinking of the future. But what we say is we have a whole array of tools in the form of national instructions, directives and circulars issued by the national commissioner and the national head of the DPCI in respect of search and seizures and operations. So we disagree with that statement that there are no rules. First round continues on slide 13, Honorable Chair and members. In terms of the provision, clause 34, technical assistance and other assistance as may be reasonably necessary must be provided to a SAPS official or investigator when they search or access computer data or computer systems. And they indicate the law of failure to comply by them, the electronic communication service providers or the financial institutions, they commit an offence if they don't comply with that technical assistance that they must render. So you can see on the top, that still on the first part of the slide, this provision of the law does not take into account the resources, the capacity and the availability of normal day-to-day running of business. And such other assistance as used in the law as required is set out too broadly in accordance with their submission and may even be something which the financial institution is unable to provide. They proposed a wording on that, Honourable Chair and members, as to how clause 29.1 should be amended. What you basically can see there, they added the word practicably possible. That can easily also become a defence. If you're under investigation, anything is stressful. Anything is stressful. So we're not in support of these proposals, because we say that it might create a possible defense or an excuse not to assist, and we submit there that the financial institution is the best placed to provide that technical assistance during the search and seizure. The opposite of that is we can bring a member from a police station which cannot render that type of assistance. The best person to render that assistance is the person hosting the system, because they know it. We again say that these objections can be raised in a court of law, and we also say that if there are concerns about this level of technical assistance, this is a matter that we can also address in the standard operating procedures to be issued, because we are still going to be consulting with our stakeholders, and it's a matter that we can to an extent address in the standard operating procedures. Honorable Chair and members, I'm on slide 14. First round is our biggest respondent. They still continue with their submissions. On the top you will see they are concerned about the application in clause 42 be we made of an oral application as opposed to a written application for a preservation of evidence direction. And it is not clear to first round what is the time limit for a preservation of evidence direction. Honorable members, chairperson, you can see the answer somewhat bold there in front of you. If one considers the law very clearly, clause 42 states specifically the time period of a preservation order. It says 90 days, not exceeding 90 days. So that was perhaps a quick read. The answer is in the current bill as it is. If I can take you to slide 15, Honourable Chair and Members. First round continue with clause 54. Here is the reporting of a financial institution or an electronic communication service provider to report to the SAPS within 72 hours of becoming aware of a cybercrime on their system and to preserve information which may be of assistance to law enforcement in investigating the offence. Their submission is that this law or this provision does not take into account that it's not always reasonable and or practical to report within that time period. No time period has been provided for preservation, which is incorrect statement. And they come then with the proposal that this period of 72 hours must be extended to 5 business days. I can just mention in discussions with our minister yesterday, and it's obviously, we know that this is the norm and the standard that has been set, but I just for the sake of the House, when we had a discussion with the minister yesterday, he indicated to us that he would even like to see this period sooner than 72 hours. His question to us was in front of him, but why do we take 72 hours? Do you know how long 72 hours really is? We would really like to see it immediately, but I'm mentioning to you what was said to us in a discussion with the minister yesterday. But what we're saying is we cannot support a proposal of 5 business days. We actually want that information immediately, because any delay is a miscarriage of justice and a lost opportunity, as we indicate there, Chair and members, honourable members, that rapid response is essential, otherwise we're going to have a losing battle on our hand. A proposal that we want to make here, that I also had a discussion with the minister yesterday, honourable chair and members, we say that, and we say what we say in the red here, I will highlight with other submissions. You see it from these entities; they want to make confidential reports. They are concerned how their reports is going to be dealt with, and the proposal, as you see it there, chair and honourable members, is that we perhaps wonder whether we cannot have a little tweak to have these reports in terms of clause 54 to be made to the SAPS point of contact structure that is created by clause 52. But it's only in relation to the clause 54 reporting obligations. We're not speaking of the ordinary cybercrime incidents that every member of society will experience. In discussions with the minister yesterday, he said we must not excuse the person who cannot get access to this contact point. If we have a wonderful idea here to report online, we might lose the evidence that the ordinary member of society can bring us that does not have the luxury to liaise with this nodal point. And in discussion with the minister, he said yesterday to us, looking at this proposal, we should perhaps, and this is a matter, Chair, that even might be arranged internally in the police. It might not even be necessary to amend the law. It can be an internal arrangement, but in view of what the minister said to us yesterday, to give the opportunity to ordinary society that will not have the luxury of online report to a center somewhere in the police service, that we must have a sort of a dedicated capacity at the police to receive that, and that the police take it forward to this designated point of contact, so that we don't lose the intelligence and the evidence that we get from an ordinary member of society. Thank you, Chairperson, Honourable Chair and Members. We're going to the next bank now. We're on slide 16, JP Morgan Bank. They sort of conflict them. First of all, they say 72 hours seems reasonable, but they would prefer no time frame. In the light of what we've already said to you, Chairperson and Honourable Members, we have expressed our view on that. We cannot work with no time frame. We're saying even 72 hours may be challenging. So our response is noted in the previous slide. Honourable Chair and Members, if I can take you to slide 17, we have the respondent Media Monitoring Africa. In our analysis of their submissions, we found one aspect that directly speaks to us as SAPS. They are concerned that public officials involved in the investigation and prosecution of cybercrimes are not educated as opposed to trained. This is the word that they used in this regard. Honorable Chair and members, first of all, I must tell you that we indeed, and I'm perhaps not the best person to speak about it, but I have background information about that. But what I can assure the House, we have capacity in the police and our intelligence environment, in our investigative environment. Cyber is not a new thing for the police. The fact that there's now a cyber bill didn't open new methodology or new thinking. We've been doing this for a couple of years, and as the National Commissioner indicated to you, we have also got an advanced cybercrime strategy that is in advanced stage of finalization that I think is ahead of what is expected of us in law. It is far more than what the law is expecting of us. So we do have that capacity, and they do sterling work. I can vouch for it in my personal capacity. We obviously also refer to the responses in terms of Clause 55 that creates now a legal obligation on our Honourable Minister to create sufficient human and resources capacity in the police to ensure that training is conducted on various levels. And these things are ongoing at this moment. The National Commissioner, when he engaged with him last week, he also indicated that cybercrime is now part of the curriculum of the Crime Detection University. It is matters that we have put high on our agenda. We are not sleeping, Honourable Chair and members. I think we are ahead with this. Honourable Chair and members, if I can take you to slide 18, the submissions of MTN, they carry on. They're also concerned about the so-called extensive seizure powers of the police service. And then they make a proposal in the second paragraph on slide 15. They say a magistrate should not be authorizing warrants, and it must be the designated judge in terms of the Regulation of Interception of Communications Act. That is their submission. They also make submissions that, if possible, that they provide the police with digital copy of evidence. We have not taken a specific stance in relation to the digital copy. We live in the digital area. We cannot deny the status of digital documents these days. But it's a matter, and I will address it in the following slide. MTN carries on slide 18 at the bottom. They're also concerned about the SOPs, that there should be no action taken when we execute our operations to impair the functions of their computers or their storage media, and that we should not be disrupting their services of electronic communication service provider or its customers, which are not implicated in the offense, or reducing service quality to those persons. Those are concerns that they raise. On slide 19, Honorable Chair and members, they carry on with their submissions. They submit that SAPS is actually allowed to take a whole electronic communications network of a service provider, and that limitations should be set to only access control information. They are concerned that their daily operations may be affected by our so-called extensive search and seizure powers, and as indicated earlier, they have a proposal for digital copies. They also request, like the previous respondent, that reports that they make be made on a confidential basis, which to an extent we can understand because you're dealing with business entities here and their records. It's not Van Graan that did a local transaction at the cafe. Honourable Chair and members, our response to MTN is contained on slide 20. We first of all say that these concerns, or a number of them made by MTN and like other respondents, can be addressed during the public consultation process that's prescribed for the standard operating procedures. And here comes our proposal, which we don't know what leeway we'll receive, Honourable Chair and members. The law as it is right now, the bill, says that within a period of 6 months after the commencement of the chapter in which that provision is contained, the police must be ready with the standard operating procedures. In the light of the submissions that we see for extensive consultation, which is a public consultation process apart from the senior officials which must be consulted in government, We feel that 6 months might be very challenging to do that. We want to put to you, Honourable Chair and members, if we can possibly look at a period of 12 months, but we obviously in your hands, Honourable Chair and members. We have discussed it with the Minister also, and we said to him what we're proposing here, that the 12 months, which he also indicated to us his support, but obviously, ma'am, we are in your hands. What we also say is, they carry on MTN to say that the definitions of computer and computer storage medium is broad and vague. It may lead to vague search warrants and directions. We disagree with that. We think there's quite clear description of these concepts in the law. And then, interestingly enough, we don't see any counter proposal made by MTN for the concerns that they raise. MTN is on slide 21, we carry on, Honourable Chair and members. They also concerned about our search and seizure powers, and as I indicated earlier, they don't want to see a magistrate issuing a warrant. And here is our response on the top of slide 21. Our job will come to a standstill if the magistrates of this country cannot assist us in search warrants. They do it daily with thousands of applications in complicated matters. And I really cannot see what is the substantiation for that. To ask that the dedicated judge that is responsible for interception directions be dedicated to this task will take this poor judge away from his normal functions and will affect crime intelligence specifically in their matters that they are addressing. What we say is the Criminal Procedure Act for any investigation of any nature, a magistrate can issue a warrant. And this is how we do our business, and this is how we set our rules. So we're not in support of that proposal. And we ask, why is cybercrime treated differently? And we indicate there that the RICO judge has a very specific function for which the judge is appointed. There is no responsibilities given to that judge in the cybercrime bill. And we don't think it is the place to do it in that place, with respect, Honourable Chair and members. As you heard before from the submission, they are concerned that we can seize their actual electronic communications network. We as SAPS cannot find substantiation for this submission in the definition of seize, that a whole network can be seized. But we must also state that anything that is relevant to a criminal investigation can be seized. Technically speaking, anything that is an exhibit or is relevant concerned in the commission of a crime can be seized. I don't think we can negotiate about those aspects. But when matters such as this come up, this is obviously something that there will be two-way communication about, because we cannot bring a system down and have a civil claim of millions of rands because we're looking for one page. So this is a matter that must be treated with sensitivity and on both sides. But in the law, we don't see that it's possible to seize an actual network. And again, we put forward, Honourable Chairperson and members, that these are also issues that we can address to an extent in our standard operating procedures to be formalised. Chairperson, members, Honourable, if I can take you to slide 22. There are concerns also by MTN, the obstruction of a police official or an investigator. That's an investigator that assists the police in investigations and is there on authority of a warrant. They are concerned that this clause and seizures by the SAPS may affect their daily operations. And again, they propose the digital copy. As we stated, this can be arranged in the SOPs because there will be consultation with the NDPP also on the type of evidence that can be admitted for what cases and for what circumstances. They also propose that their reports be made on a confidential basis, which we support. That proposal that there be confidentiality, we support that. Honourable Chair and members, if I can take you to slide 23, we have received a number of general concerns by Telkom. Telkom did not criticize anything pertinently. They record their own concerns, and those concerns are summarized to you all on slide 23, and you can just look at the bold print. They are worried that they cannot comply or fully comply with these preservation orders, that they might have inadequate storage capacity to store these things or to preserve this evidence, and that it will impose a heavy burden on them and create a duty on them that they might not be able to fulfill. But those are general remarks that have been made. They also stressed that these SOPs that is in the bill must be drafted in consultation with the industry. It's prescribed already by law, and that the ambit of these directives as well are very clear to avoid any unintended effects. General remarks, Chair, there's nothing where they pertinently refer to the police service except to note their general remarks there. They carry on slide 24, Honourable Chair and members, about the SOPs, that it must be clear, that there must be special procedures when it comes to search and seizure, which I think this bill creates. It creates a regime for cyber investigation and cyber process. So the clear direction is already contained in the bill. And then general remarks, as I said, that does not, or a remark that does not impact pertinently on the police service. What we say is we support this process of consultation as indicated in relation to all the other respondents, but we must indicate as much as Telkom is concerned about preservation of orders, we will welcome this. This is a procedural power that the SAPS never had at its disposal. As a matter of fact, when I came back from the briefing yesterday from the minister, there was a request from Interpol in a foreign country that want us to preserve data. And it's complex because there is no such a provision in law. We had to work out some strategy how we will go about, and my response was we will basically have to do this on the basis of consent and then subject to a mutual legal assistance process. But Madam Chair and Honourable Members, mutual legal assistance processes are very tedious, very long, stretch out processes. So what we're saying to you, we welcome this procedural power that we've never had. We have never had it and we welcome it. It's new to us. If we can carry on, Honourable Chairperson and members, to slide 25, assistance to a police official. You will remember previous respondent also complained about this clause, the technical assistance, and you can see that this is a mirror image of the other respondent. Exactly the same words were used, and they are also concerned about the effect of this technical assistance and how far they must go, and they're concerned about that. They are concerned also that such order that is served on them or police operations must not disrupt their services. I'm reading in the middle of clause of slide 25, Honourable Chair and members, and as we indicate there, it's also in line with the proposals made by MTN and First Rands. We say that these can be addressed in the standard operating procedures. And again, we want to emphasize the role of private entities and civil society. As I indicated earlier and also in deliberations with the National Commissioner last week, the risk management of these companies must improve. That we say, because the better their risk management is, the less chance of us disrupting the systems. So we both have a dual responsibility, and we both have to talk to each other. We are not islands. We have to talk to each other because we are both affected by the scourge of cybercrime. Honourable Chair and members, if I can take you to slide 26. Vodacom came up with something which I don't quite understand where they got it from, but I say it with the greatest respect. They say, in the second paragraph on top of slide 26, when a preservation order is received that carry a top secret classification, they cannot comply with it. Our blunt response is, you will not receive crime intelligence documents that's classified. You will get an order from court. that you must execute. So that document will not have classified status in terms of our current legislation. It might be sensitive, but it is a document and an order by court that went through many hands. So that concern is unfounded. The penultimate page of our submission, Chairperson, on slide 27. Vodacom did not say anything specifically with relation to the 72 hours, but they are concerned about the information which they must provide, because currently the law says they must preserve any information, and they basically want a list. A list. That is impossible. I always use this example. If you ask someone when can he or she shoot, you cannot draw a list and say in these circumstances you can shoot. It's impossible. Because the merits of any matter will indicate what is relevant, what is evidence, what is an exhibit, what is an instrumentality of crime. It is impossible to comply with that. In submission, we say that, Honourable Chair and Members. Now, if I can take the Honourable Chairperson and Members to the last slide, and we are feeling very passionate about especially the first one, we are appreciative that the law allows the police to, in limited circumstances, act without a warrant, because we must be very realistic about that. We live not in a perfect world, Madam Chair and Members. There are emergencies. And if I say emergencies, I'm not speaking about a lazy cop or someone who wants to jump the system. I'm speaking about real emergencies, which make it very challenging to always have a warrant. If you have a dedicated project or an investigation or a case docket, you know exactly where you're going and what you're looking for and where you're going to gather that evidence. But when you have a suspect, for instance, an example that we use here, who leaves his cell phone on a cash in transit scene, and this matter is being followed up, it's fluid, it is in hot pursuit. The law, with its limitation on search and seizure, says, no, we can act without a warrant, we can seize this object, but we cannot look at it. We ask, Madam Chair and Members, Honourable, that is it possible to, in very limited circumstances, extend the powers to also give us access without a warrant? In the example that I cite here, where you have a crime, we are in pursuit of the criminals, we don't even know what we will find on this tool. We don't even know to who it belongs. Now we must convince a magistrate or a judge 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning that we want a warrant to find the evidence in here so that we can pursue the criminal. That is an earnest submission that we want to ask, that we can get limited access in limited circumstances, not as a general rule, for exactly the example that we cited there, Chairperson. And then a little technical tweak, the last one, is the definition of a designated police official. This is important to us because this designated police official will perform certain official functions, will liaise with the judge and the judicial authority. And we say that instead of the word commissioned officer as is currently used in the definition, that we just change it to captain, because in our rank system, a captain and higher, in theory, is in any case a commissioned officer. But the commissioning in itself is a technical aspect that we would like to avoid if we can, and we can sidestep that by, instead of using the word commissioned officer, say rank of a captain or higher designated by a national commissioner and a national head of the directorate, respectively. Honourable Chair and Members, thank you for the opportunity to make this submission to you. Appreciate it. Thank you, General, for allowing me.
Thank you very much, Brigadier van der Sant. I'm not sure, Deputy Minister, if you want to say something, because you missed out the opportunity earlier.
No, Chair, except to wish you well for, together with the committee and your staff, for 2020. May it be a good year for you. and the members. Otherwise, I think we should allow members to interact with our presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Honourable members, are we... Sorry, Honourable Mikalakis, you're whispering to me, I can't hear you.
I just think perhaps before we ask questions whether the Department of Justice wants to respond to this, because it is, after all, their bill.
No, we are coming to that stage. Maybe I should ask Honourable members, do you want to interact with the presentation, not in terms of the proposals that the department is making, but just in terms of whether you want clarity on any aspects that they presented. The Department of Justice is the lead department in terms of this piece of legislation, and we would also expect them to respond on the proposals that are made by the South African Police Services. I'll allow members just to deal with the questions of clarity so that we can have a better understanding of what is presented. And following that, we'll then ask the NPA then to present, and finally we'll get the Department of Justice so that they present as well as respond on some of the proposals, right? Honourable members, it's over to you. Honourable Mikalakis, is there any other member? Honourable Nita, Honourable Dudobu, Honourable Mola. In that order. Honourable Mikalakis.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chairperson, I just have two or three questions. The first one is pertaining to slide 13, where SAPS says that objections can be raised in court or through litigation. My question is that with an economy that's already under pressure and the government itself not having too much money to spend on litigation, I would think, because this would be on a case-to-case basis, and in the end, you're going to end up spending, both by the government and the private sector, spending quite a bit of money on litigation. I don't really think that that is a practical or the best solution. I would like to hear the comments from SAPS on that specific point. I would think that it would be a better option to perhaps find a way that is more agreeable, even if it has to take more dialogue, but you find a way that's more agreeable between the companies and the state. But I'm not too much of a fan of the idea of going on a case-to-case basis to court and incurring all these expenses, especially in the circumstances that we find ourselves currently. My second question is just on the point that the Minister apparently made yesterday with regards to the physical point of contact. In my opinion, if you're the victim of a cyber crime, then you most likely have internet. So I don't really see the need of that. The people who would in the end up being victims would all have access to internet because it's an internet crime. So I don't really understand the rationale for or the need for a physical point of contact, and then, not the physical one, but for SAPS to then ultimately submit that. And then my third question is just on capacity of the police service. I firstly want to suggest perhaps, Chairperson, that once the bill is passed, or even sooner, that we perhaps have a session with SAPS with regards to the training specifically, simply because I'm of the opinion that except for one or two questions, I think this is a very, very good piece of legislation. But I do think that if there is one place where the ball might get dropped, it is at SAPS and with regards specifically to capacity. Now, we have been indicated over here that SAPS has the capacity. But my question is, on an earlier occasion when I asked the question, it was replied to me by the Minister of Police that and perhaps before I say this, I have to say that the specialised unit within the Hawks, I think, does excellent work, but they are under pressure. I think they're brilliant, but they are under pressure. And the response that I got from the Minister was that they would need currently an extra 20 million rand a year to properly fund it.
With the bill, I think that requirement would actually increase, as well as this is 2-3 years ago. So, I mean, they need much more than that. But also, in another response that I got was, in the last 6 years, of the 937 cases that were investigated, 178 were successfully prosecuted. Again, I say I don't think it is a reflection on the capabilities and the commitment of the police officers that we have there. On the contrary, I think they're excellent. I rather think it is a question of this specific unit not being prioritized in terms of budget and capacity and skills, because it is a very specialized case. Well, in the end, the value of what was investigated, the indication I got was it's 8 billion rand, but only 23.7 million rand rand's worth of crime was successfully prosecuted. So to say that SAPS at the moment is properly capacitated, I think, with great respect, is not completely accurate. And in that regard, I would, from the Deputy Minister, and I'm very glad that he's here, like a response to find out how in the coming budget cycle he is going to firstly properly capacitate in terms of funding the unit, and then going forward after the bill has been adopted to actually make that step further. It's a lot of money that's going to be required, and remembering the budget that we're currently in, I do not think that SAPS is prioritizing the right things to actually fully capacitate this. So it doesn't help we have an excellent bill on the table, but and the police is willing, but they don't have the budget, firstly. And secondly, they don't have the capacity in terms of human resources. We've got very limited resources, and two or three people can't be expected or eight people or ten people can't be expected to deal with this caseload. They need some assistance. It doesn't help we have excellent police men and women out there, and they are simply overworked and underpaid and not supported in actually making sure that this, quite frankly, mostly excellent legislation becomes a success. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I also had a point in terms of, let's first appreciate the presentation. It was really well done, Chair. I wanted to start with the point where the last speaker left off, Chair. Because I was just asking myself, the department in responding to the issue of capacity, I hope they are not in the defense mode. Because it's important for us as NCOP to pass really a bill that will be really functional. And two, as this house, we are one house that is not there only to criticize, but also to assist departments where we can. That's why I am listening on that point of the last speaker, because as NCOP would like to know if we are to start implemented, will we really have capacity in terms of what the presenters, the people that were consulted are saying, the capacity of yourself in terms of cybercrime. We really would like to know the factual answer without being defensive, so that we're able to help you in terms of pushing for the budget for you to be able even to further capacitate the staff of the department. Two, Chair, is on the issue of the search and seizure. It's coming up very strong from the people that we have consulted, the stakeholders. And again, on that one, Chair, one thing that they are highlighting very strongly is when you do that, it doesn't tamper with the business of those stakeholders. I hope even on this one, they will take it very serious and be able to make sure that when they do that, they are really able to be in control of ensuring that it doesn't make any harm. The last one, Chen. and you know, turn the app. I have the last one. Please check. Come back to me after. Check my notes.
Okay. Honorable Dodo.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and I want to join the queue to welcome the presentation. I think it was quite comprehensive, and one has to think a lot about the issues that are raised. But I want to start by supporting what Honorable Nwita is saying. And I'm not saying that the SAPS is wrong, but my sense is that we seem to be very defensive in responding to the questions and the issues that are raised by stakeholders. And I'm not saying that they are wrong and you are right, or you are wrong that they are right, but the sense that I get is that anything that is raised here, you seem to be saying, we're not supporting, we reject, we do not agree, and so on and so forth. And that raises my concern. I'm raising this point, Honorable Chair, specifically because the economic impact of cybercrime in this country is very huge. 6 billion rands per annum is lost as a result of cybercrime. Now, we are told that the victims of cybercrime globally could be about 50%, and in South Africa it's about 70%. Just people who are falling victims of smartphone scams globally is about 38%, and here in South Africa it's 47%. I'm raising the point because you say we are ready, we are equipped, we have the capacity to investigate cybercrime. And if that is the case, and if that assertion that you're making, I should agree with it. In the balance of evidence, it doesn't show me that you are winning, because as I pointed out, global statistics, when we compare them to the South African statistics, are telling us a different picture. And for me, that is quite important. Chair, I'm raising this point because of the following. Cybercrime incidents have now changed in our country. We have problems like, for example, impersonation, where people impersonate others in the social media, where they change or they clone the profiles of people, where they use other names of people to commit certain things in the social media. That everything has changed, and for me, I am not sure as to what capacity do we have to investigate such crimes. I'm sure in the course of this year, Honorable Chair, could be quite useful that SAPS come to us and say, this is our capacity, this is the training that we offer to our members, this is what we do to investigate all these particular issues. For me, as matters stand, I'm a bit worried that do we really, really have the capacity, more especially when all the stakeholders, most of them are raising the issue of capacity to investigate, to attend to all these particular issues. And for me, it becomes the centerpiece of what we are going to do immediately after this particular law has been passed. And I really want to sincerely implore on you to look at that, to take the issue of the capacity to investigate, to ensure that those who are responsible, the criminals, are prosecuted and are held liable as a result of the cybercrime that is perpetuated in our country. For me, that is quite important. It must be something that we are attending to. Now, my question is, what is limited access? Your last slide was saying we want to have an access, limited access to the phone without obtaining a warrant if a crime is perpetuated, or if we have a cell phone on the crimes. What do you mean with limited access? Because the fact of the matter is that once you open the phone, you'll go through it unlimitedly. more especially when you don't know who it belongs to, you don't know what is contained in that, you don't know what crime, if any, that has been committed via that cell phone. And if you say we want just a mere limited access, what do you mean? For me, it is access. Access is access, and that is what we need to be told, that we need access because we have this property in our possession and we want to investigate crime because we don't know what is in. So that we are clear, we are blunt, we are honest about what is it that we really want to do. Those are my issues, Honorable Chair. Thanks.
Honorable Mola.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for your presentation. Mine is two questions, but the other member has raised it. But I want to be sure, in slide 17, about the capacity. Are your members trained on cybercrime? And how many members are trained? And when was your last training? My last question, Honorable Dodovo has covered me on what do you mean by saying limited access. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Nija. Your third issue?
Thanks, Chair. My third issue is on the issue of search warrants, Chair. Yes, I heard them saying they would like to be given a kind of a leeway in terms of this particular crime, which I hope, Chair, when we are having a presentation from Department of Justice, because I tend to agree with them that this particular crime is a quite complicated and we are dealing with people that are quite advanced in terms of technology. I am sure in terms of search warrants, we need to treat it differently. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. I think just a comment which Honorable Dodovo raised in terms of support and oppose. My understanding is when you opposing a comment is because you're explaining how it's covered in terms of that piece of legislation. I think it's just a use of semantics, and generally we avoid that kind of use. But let me hand over to the department to just respond to some of those issues. I know the Department of Justice will address some of your proposals, but there are clarity-seeking questions around your proposals.
Yeah, Honorable Chair, thank you very much. And we also want to express our appreciation to the Honorable Members for good questions and comments. I think they are very helpful. The first point we wanna try and put it right or balance it is that firstly we're not defensive, and if it might have been interpreted likewise, we apologize and withdraw. And I will start with the capacity because that is the issue at hand. Firstly, I want to come to a point where we say the process of following a bill up to a point where it becomes a legislation, there's a space for resource requirement for the implementation of that particular bill. We're still getting to that particular stage. And therefore, we are not confirming final that we are ready with resourcing. Secondly, we also indicated that we are at an advanced stage of developing a cybercrime strategy, which is also going to be attached to a resource requirement. And that resource requirement is going to form part and parcel of capacity as part of the requirement. I think the presenter has been referring to a current and previous situation, because as the South African Police Service, we had an obligation to respond when such crime has been reported. But what we also want to further bring to the attention of the committee is that the cyber modus operandi has advanced to another level, which is putting another stretch again on resource requirement. Therefore, the issue of capacity, it's a requirement that moves from current to the future. But then cybercrime is a multi-dimensional type of a crime. There is a dimension that SARS is responsible for, but it's a crime that requires multidisciplinary collaborative approach, in which you then also need the integration of resources approach. So there's quite an investment that is required here. But what is in the SARS plan by now, through human capital investment, we're moving towards putting the first crime detection academy university. If things goes well in April, one of the first curriculums, top priority curriculum, is the cybercrime training curriculum, which we have already started tasking people to work on. And we think then that will help us with capacity. But we will need support, obviously, from this committee, because as I'm speaking, there are no resources set aside for cybercrime. We still need to determine those particular resources. I'm sure then the other questions, they will be more operational, except to say that all the SOPs that we will be developing, the bill shall still be read with all the other legislations that are not repealed, like the Criminal Procedure Act and others, and previous SOPs that were developed out of those legislations, they shall be read with the SOPs that emanate from this particular bill. If there's any amendment, we will then be looking at such. And complementing this is also the online policing strategy, because cyber crime is also exploiting the online platforms, and communities are busy and rapidly relocating to online, and we want then also to provide that particular response. So maybe I should close it here and hand over to the Deputy Minister. I'm not sure the presenter, if you want to take a few operational questions before the Deputy Minister wraps.
General, let the Deputy Minister continue. We have a whole panel of operational experts. You know, I'm just a lawyer, so, but together we can find it.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, General, and the head of the Hawks present here, and the delegation. I think the National Commissioner responded broadly to the questions, including the question that was supposed to be answered by the Deputy Minister with regard to the budget and capacitation of the unit. I just want to say to members that as the South African Police Service, we are doing everything possible to enhance the capacity that is there. We do have personnel currently that deals with issues that have to do with cyber. But we have come to conclude that it is necessary to lift or to enhance the capacity internally. the minister pronounced, I think last year, that towards the end of the year, that there is a process which is led by the deputy minister and the national commissioner to develop the facility that we are currently using to train detectives in Hammanskraal, so that it is in par with what is happening throughout the world, and we have been interacting with countries that we think we can look at how they are handling their issues, like your US, your China, and we will also be interacting with the United Kingdom. We are interacting with the law enforcement agencies of this institution in terms of how they are doing things, and we have observed that we are not necessarily backward, because work has been there, and you'll agree with me that policing in the country is something that has been going on for many years. Of course, we have the South African Police Service today in its current form, but the work police that have been doing in the country stretches many, many years to date. So we do have the capability, we do have the ability to do certain things, but we need to enhance that ability. The bill is very clear if when you look at the section at clause 55 that they are talking about. If something is there and it doesn't need to be improved, you don't create it. But the clause says the minister must build capacity in SAPS to deal with cyber crime. It is saying, this clause is saying so that you enhance what is there. You can't say we have everything, let it come, we'll deal with it. It won't be correct, because even if you go to the United States, like I said, we were there, we found that they are grappling with the similar challenges that we are grappling with, and they are responding to those challenges. United States as is, you know, when you understand where it stands vis-a-vis our country, they are developing it. China, they are developing it. Of course, I can't talk about the UK because we are going there, I think this month or next month. So even ourselves, when you deal with cyber, you will never reach a stage that we have everything, that we will be lying if we say that, because technology is evolving. There is 5G today, and here in South Africa we are not yet there. So you can't deal with something that you are not there yet. By the time we arrive at 5G as a country, there will be 6G, 7G probably. So the need to continuously capacitate ourselves will always be there. The NCOP have a role to play. We will never succeed in the implementation of this bill once it becomes an act without the NCOP playing its central role. Members of the NCOP, before they come here, they are community members. They have experiences like I did before I became part of the team of when I was in small business, of somebody going into the social media and becoming myself and talking to people that they must do this and that, and I have my own experiences then in trying to deal with that matter. So you have a role to play, and we will be more than happy and willing to engage with you. And I agree with what the National Commissioner said, that if we have created an impression of being defensive, that is not our intention, because in any case, it is required of us to consult, not for the sake of consulting, that we come to you and consult you, you give us a proposal that, you know, instead of putting this there, you should have put that. And if you put that, it doesn't change materially the content. Why not put it? Because the intention is to interact and be influenced by those that we interact with, and of course ourselves to also influence them. So we might have come out as being defensive. We have no intention to do that. And where we get advice that we think can enhance the bill better, we will gladly accept that. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. I think that from your side, you're not providing any further comment, right? There was a question asked around the point of contact issue, but I think, I'm not sure, Saro, if you'll be covering that issue as well as the issue of limited access.
That will be covered. Yes. Regarding limited access, probably respond to why the South African police is here. In terms of clauses 32 and 33 of the bill, initially when we promote the bill, police were in certain instances granted the power to access electronic device, although they're not in possession of a warrant, but they believe that a warrant will be issued to them. That is something similar than that is currently in the Criminal Procedure Act. It was taken out more or less at the fall of the bill. We tried to finalize the bill quickly, since that was an objection that was not fully addressed. I think the police approached me after that to reconsider the matter. I did research on that clauses 32 and 33, and the international position is more or less as follows. In Canada, we get two Supreme Court cases in that regard. The one is R versus VU, VU, and in terms of that judgment, the court said you always need a warrant to access a computer system. But then, more or less in similar circumstances that was explained by Brigadier Van Graan, the next case before the Canadian Supreme Court was that of R versus Fearon, 2014, which involved cell phones and drug transactions, where the police did access that. And then the Supreme Court of Canada did make an exemption to the general rule. Say, in exigent circumstances, where evidence is going to be lost, where there is life and limb situations, the police may access without a warrant. If you go to the United States, you get a case of, I think it is Riley, this is California, and the search and seizure of a cell phone took place more or less on a certain circumstances that was explained by Brigadier Van Graan, and the court ultimately decided in that case, no, you need a warrant to access. The latest case was that of the U.S. District Court of Massachusetts in the case of Kashan al-Sadid, and the court ruled there around about in November 2019. That warrant is in all cases necessary to search and seize a device. Okay, like I said, the Criminal Procedure Act Section 22B do allow for warrantless searches in exigent circumstances. You can also look at the South African case that was the Miller judgment. It's the only decided case actually in South Africa that deals with warrantless searches of the cellular phone, where police again access a cell phone, and the court ruled that admissible, so it can take place without a cell phone. So universally there's no clear authority. On one hand they require warrant, on the other hand not. My submission is if it relates to certain crime scene investigations, situations of life and limb, exceptions should be provided, similar to sections in the Criminal Procedure Act, to provide for warrantless searches. Well, the NPA, I think it's lowest here, you can probably also add to this, he helped to prepare the submissions that we're going to give to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Cyril. I'll then request the NPA to make their input. Though we have not received any presentation from yourself, are you going to speak off the cuff? Or do you have a presentation?
Ms. Chairperson, let me clarify to an extent. Sorry, Advocate Lowe did provide substantial input, and we did decide to consolidate this since most of this input relates to the full mandate of the National Prosecuting Authority. But Advocate Lowe can probably give his impressions on the bill as such.
Okay.
I think he was involved from the start of the drafting thereof, and he's got extensive experience in cyber investigations as well as foreign legislation. So the presentation that I am going to give to the committee will cover both the NPA and the input of justice.
Just a point of clarity, Cyril, before the NPA speaks. You're saying in terms of your presentation, you've incorporated their input. But just in terms of SAP's input, is that also covered in your presentation?
It is covered. Each and every aspect that the SAPS addressed is also addressed in my presentation.
Okay.
Due to the fact that I need to explain the whole bill and each and every comment on that.
Thanks for that clarity. I think we would be concerned if it wasn't. But thank you. Advocate Lowe, over to you.
Honourable Madam Chair, honourable members, all dignitaries, National Commissioner, Deputy Minister, I would like to say for me it's an honour to be here today, first time ever in Parliament. So I'm a novice and you must bear with me. I just want to compliment this committee first of all because, and Cyril with the Department of Justice and the police, because I've been working practically with cybercrime since 2001 and I've been grappling with these issues in the trenches of Johannesburg and Pretoria and Cape Town with the question, shall we embark on a search, for instance, without a warrant or with a warrant. And when I started working with Cyril on this bill, my question first of all, and you must remember, I always said that this Parliament has done very well with legislation because it has given us in law enforcement the tools to fight crime. And, you know, it's at the level of implementation I always felt there's a challenge. But we always had, since 1998, we had tools, thanks to this Parliament. And the Electronic and Communications and Transactions Act, ACTA, was there in the law books in the early 2000s. Whereas if we look at countries like the Philippines, for instance, they had the Lovebug virus and all their computers were rendered useless. And there was no legislation in place at that time to combat crime. Whereas in South Africa, we had those tools. So when we started with this bill, I asked the following question. First of all, will we cover for, and as the National Commissioner and the Deputy Minister said, you know, evolving crime, we're becoming more sophisticated day by day. Will our offences cover for technologies, but not only technologies, near technologies? And throughout this process, and I can tell Madam Chair, Honourable Members, that I've looked at crimes like WannaCry, like the denials of service attacks in California, and I asked Harold, can we draft a charge sheet based on the offences? And time and time and again, we came back and we said, yes, we can. and this is covered by this bill, and that's why I started off with a compliment. The modern notion, Madam Chair, is to catch these criminals in a matter of hours, not weeks and months. Because I was thinking when Brigadier Van Graan said, we know that proposal of 5 days. 5 days is ancient history. The minister is correct when he said to Brigadier Van Graan, we must catch these people within hours. And I believe that, especially when it comes to reporting, we are on song, and it's correct, and I trust Brigadier Van Graan's approach to this. I think it's with modern trends. On the question of training, Honorable National Commissioner, I cannot thank you more for this university, because if you read the textbooks of Peter Sommer of Oxford University and so on, mistakes made early in the investigation, you know, can blow up in your face. They say, University of California, a professor once wrote, digital evidence is like nitroglycerin, you know, properly handled, you will blow your opponent, the criminal, out of the water. But if you don't handle it properly, it will blow up in your face. And that's why the training emphasis is so fantastic. And I fully support that, and I would love to try and give training in that regard. The question of search and seizures. You know, I've instructed my teams when we were working, Brigadier Peter says here, and he's always been at my side, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, assessing the situation, we decided to go with a warrantless search. But 1 o'clock in the morning, I said, no, we decided together. We always sat in the car and decided together. We are going to apply for a warrant, a search warrant. Why? Because we want to stand with clean hands before court. Why? Because we respect the constitutional rights of any person, whether it's a criminal or not, or it's a suspect or not. And the whole question of access to, for instance, a cell phone, was so topical for us. Because in the case Advocate Roberts referred you to Riley versus California. Initially, the Californian court decided that, you know, it's like searching a person. We had the rights in terms of Section 23. You can search his body and so on, and that includes the cell phone. But it was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Canadian court, and the Indian court. All followed that trend. And I think we are right up there in South Africa. Limited access, yes, in exigent circumstances. By the way, on the question of point of contact, I'm so glad that this point of contact is now formalized. I've been doing that job since 2006. I've been a 24/7 nodal point. But like Brigadier Van Graan said, it's a question of goodwill and consent. You know, I would phone the service providers, say, please just preserve the bar data. And in 99% of all these cases, they cooperated with us. And then the formal MLAT process followed. But your problem is the police-to-police intelligence, because you need that information yesterday to catch a criminal. Also there, I'm happy. And yes, Madam Chair, I will leave it to Advocate Roberts, to go into the more technical detail of this presentation. But in general, it's an honor for me to be here, and wherever I can contribute, I will. And I will afterwards, if necessary, contribute even more. Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable members.
Thank you, Advocate. Honourable members, I'm going to just get the Department of Justice to make their presentation, and then we'll engage further. You might have to get closer to the mic. There's quite a noise outside.
Yes. Is this better? Can everybody hear? Okay. The presentation that I did send through, it was quite voluminous. It's single lines. It's close to 100 pages. We're probably not going to finish everything today, but we'll try to go up to malicious communications at the end thereof, and then maybe at the next stage deal with the rest of the presentation. Well, since the department is responsible for the bill, it also deals with the presentations that was directed to the South African Police Service, as well as what we received from the National Prosecuting Authority. So I'll start now. On page 2 of the document, there's a presentation from Jordan Du Griffiths. Mr. Griffiths actually submitted his thesis to me. I think it was an M thesis. We actually do deal with special measures to address cybersecurity. The bill was initially also extended to cybersecurity, but it was cut down to cybercrime. But what was discussed in the committee regarding capacity building and the necessity to come in line with the involvement of crime and to address that is clear from his thesis. On page 2, I do quote excerpt from comments by the World Bank regarding capacity building. And they clearly indicate no law enforcement agency will ever be able to address all cybercrime. That's a given. Technology advances quicker than you can train people. The modus operandi of the offences advance quicker than you can think out what to put in place to address that. But what is certain is that countries must strive to try to establish the necessary capacity and to always update that capacity. As was indicated by the police, there's obligation on the police to deal with capacity building in clause 55 of the bill. In terms of the bill, since we know it's impossible to always be on the cutting edge of technology and to understand each and everything involved in cybercrime, clause 4 of the bill do provide for the appointment of investigators to assist the South African police in the investigation of cybercrime. This is not something new. It's not something that we thought out. It happens in the United Kingdom, which is probably the most advanced country currently in the world to deal with cybercrime. It's also in the Sri Lankan cyber legislation and legislation of various other countries. On page 3, this is also first a general comment. Media monitoring requested whether a SAAS was done in terms of the bill. And the answer is yes, we did the SAAS. We did provide it to the committee to distribute further. And I must point out, you don't need to consult on a SAAS. It's something to evaluate policy by the DPME in the presidency. But yes, a SAAS was done. Further on page 3, media monitoring referred to various rights that is affected in cyberspace, and identify inter alia the right to privacy, the right to access of information, and according to the commentator, the bill must take these rights into account. Our response thereto is yes. There is certain information rights, but it extends to various other rights in the Constitution not identified by media monitoring. Obviously, freedom and security of person, dignity, freedom of association, etc. And our submission is the bill do take all constitutional rights into account. In any case, in terms of the Constitution, all laws must comply with the Constitution, otherwise it will be unconstitutional. So according to the proposal by the commentators that a specific clause be inserted in the bill to address this, our submission is that this is not necessary. It's dealt with by the Constitution itself. On page 4, media monitoring again raised the issue that the crimes in the bill is in some instances vague, and it should be narrowed down, and we must ensure that it is narrowly circumscribed. Our submission is, if you compare the crimes in the bill, it's my submission that it is in line with most legislation of other countries. I can refer to the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, various African countries, our neighbours, common laws, model laws that was proposed as model text for legislation, etc. Media monitoring further referred to the position of children vis-a-vis cyber crimes and the use of computer technology. I think his main concern is that children, if they commit cyber offences, should be dealt differently than ordinary adults. Our submission is that any child that commits an offence will be dealt with in terms of the Child Justice Act, which prescribes a specific dispensation to deal with children that's in conflict with the law. If you look at the schedules to the bill, you'll see that the Child Justice Act is also further amended to prescribe certain sentences in respect of children who commit cyber offences. So my submission is that the concern by the commentator is completely addressed. He also raised the concern about necessary training of children and to inform them about the ills in cyberspace. The bill cannot deal with that. It's my submission that there's other initiatives already in place to deal with that. The Cyber Hub was established as part of a government's priority to prioritize cyber crimes and to come to terms with cyber crimes. And the Cyber Hub do provide extensive online education to children. Various internet service providers also has online training and specific initiatives to inform children about the harms of cybercrime and other computer-enabled crime, especially sexual offences, etc. On page 5, it's merely a continuation of the comment of the commentator. I think I did capture it. Go to page 6, and the concern of Telkom on page 5 of the comment is to the effect that a mere conduit clause should be inserted in the cybercrimes bill. A mere conduit clause has the effect that a service provider cannot be held accountable for offences committed via their computer systems. My submission is that this is not necessary. If you look at the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, Section 73, that Act do provide for such a mere conduit clause, and it's my submission that that clause exist, notwithstanding the cybercrime bill. So it's not necessary to cater for this. MTN again raised the concern regarding that the bill does not sufficiently, inverted commas, harmonize sufficiently with matters relating to electronic evidence and the preservation of data. And I do refer to the report of the South African Law Reform Commission that was recently finalized, which deal with electronic evidence. My submission is that the bill is not a place to deal with electronic evidence. The bill provides for criminalization and procedural matters to investigate cybercrime and to deal with mutual legal assistance. Evidentiary aspects is something outside the bill. Currently, it's addressed in the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, and at some stage, that provisions will be updated when we consider This proposed law of evidence bill by the South African Law Reform Commission. On page 7 of the submission, MTN made the remarks that the bill must consider the POPIA regarding unlawful processing of information. Various commentators in their submissions do refer to the POPIA and then equate it with the bill, and then more or less say that the bill and the POPIA differentiate on various aspects. My submission is yes, it is so. The Protection of Personal Information Act deals with the protection of personal information, not with cyber crimes. Cyber crimes bill, on the other hand, do deal with cyber crimes, and the provisions cannot be similar. For POPIA, if you contravene the principles for the processing of personal information, will probably result in something like administrative action against you. On the other hand, if you contravene the cyber crimes bill, you commit an offence. You can be sent to prison. And it's my submission that you cannot compare the one with the other. They deal with different aspects. I can also refer you to most other countries in the world. They also have legislation to deal with the protection of personal information and also have specific legislation to deal with cyber crimes. And there is a clear differentiation between these two disciplines. Going to go to definitions, that is on page 9 of the submission. Again, it was addressed by the South African Police Service. First comment of MTN was that the definitions in the bill is not in line with the Budapest Convention. The Budapest Convention is one of the conventions that is ratified by most countries to deal with cybercrime and to provide for mutual legal assistance. My submission is that if you look at the Budapest Convention, it contains three definitions, that of a computer system, computer data, traffic data, and I will discuss that later on. But if you look at the bill, that three definitions is definitions that is included in this bill. They do cater for that. Okay, the first one, MTN referred then to an article, and they say that in terms of the bill, article is defined as any data, a computer program, computer data storage medium, or computer system that's involved in a cyber crime, and that this may lead to confusion. In summary, that definition of article relates to Chapter 4 of the bill that deals with search and seizure. And it's my submission that these components is the actual components that is involved in a cybercrime. You either commit an offence against data or with data, against a computer program or with a computer program, or against a computer data storage medium or a computer system. In any event, if you look at all the legislation out there that deals with cybercrime, they acknowledge that component in their laws. Even the Budapest Convention, if you look at the description of a computer system, you will see that they describe it as including all the components of a computer system, data, computer programs, data storage mediums, etc. My submission is that the bill is in line with the Budapest Convention. Similar, MTN raised a concern regarding the definition of a computer, and that relates to any other device or equipment that are related to, connected with, or used with such a device, which is included in the definition of computer in the bill. My submission is, in the bill, a computer is defined as to include data, a computer data storage medium, etc.
Furthermore, you should look at the definition of a computer system. It's defined as one computer or two or more computers that perform or communicate with each other. So, any other device that is connected with or used with such a computer system should be included. I can give you an example. Most people know this modem you plug into a computer that grants you access to the internet. Obviously, if that thing is in a computer and it's excluded from the definition, and I access or perform any action in relation thereto, it is not part of the computer. The defense can be raised that it's not included in your definition, and it's essential to include that. In any case, the definition of computer of most other countries is broad and includes any other device or equipment that are related to or used with a computer. That is similar to the objection that was raised by Telkom. MTN then referred to the definition of computer data storage medium, and they criticized that location is being referred to in that definition, and obviously it's not. That was taken out. It was inserted previously to deal with cloud computing, where there is no physical device that demarcates the place where the data is. There is international developments in that regard. Currently, I don't think we need to address it in the bill. It can be updated later on if there's clarity regarding that. Then the definition of data message, we're on page 10, it's paragraph E. First rant refers to the definition of data message, and according to them, it's not in line with the international trend or the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act. If you look at the definition of data message and the Electronic Communications Transactions Act, you'll see that a data message is data generated, sent, received, or stored by electronic means. That is obviously part of the definition currently in the bill. And then the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act go further and say, and include voice, where voice is used in an automated transaction and a stored record. Obviously, if you look at the definition of data message, which is relevant to malicious communications, we cannot include that definition of the ECTA in the bill due to the fact that obviously there's no automated transaction. It's not the commercial transaction that's taking place. It's malicious communications. And the stored record, my submission is that is already included in the main parts of that definition, namely data generated, sent, received, or stored by electronic means, as is included in the bill. The only adder that is added in the bill is that you further define it as data where the output is in an intelligible form. Obviously, a malicious communication in encrypted form is not readable by each and every one, so it's difficult to prosecute somebody on the basis of encrypted data. MTN also criticized the definition of output of data, and then they asked whether data includes the continuous transmission of data. Output of data forms part of the UK Computer Misuse Act. It forms part of the Malaysian cybercrimes legislation, Philippines legislation as such. So it has got the specific meaning. In terms of the bill, output of data is defined as by having it displayed or in any other manner. So, how do you describe output of data? One must remember that if you talk about data, it's in binary code. It's zeros and ones. You cannot read it. Human cannot do it. You must use a program to make it legible to a human being. Computer program will display it for you. The computer program will print it for you so that a human can read it. That is output of data. Output of data is not continuous transmission of data. Transmission of data in electronic space means you send a data message from one place to another place. It is in binary code. It is data. You cannot read it. It only becomes output if you apply a program to it and you see it. So my submission is first, the definition is not vague. And secondly, it definitely does not include continuous transmission of data. On page 12, public available data, again, first rant referred to Popia. Most of their presentations relate to Popia. And they say that the bill defines public data differently from the Popia, where public available data is that which a person himself makes available, or that is that information that is contained in a record held by a public body. Again, the Popia and the bill is something different. They belong to different disciplines. I can give an example to the committee. X distributes or runs a web page. They distribute child pornography on the web page. Publishes the children's names, age, the addresses, and their telephone numbers. Obviously, that is personal information. But in terms of law enforcement, you must be able to access that and obtain it. So there's no prohibition in Popia for the law enforcement agencies not to access that data as public available data. The law enforcement agencies must do it. Even the Popia recognize that. If you refer to, amongst others, Section 42 of the Popia, which exempts the conditions for processing of personal information where law enforcement is involved. You can also look at Section 6.1 of the Popia, also exempt law enforcement agencies from the processing of personal information in accordance with the principles of the Popia. And also Section 12 of the Popia. So bottom line is, for purposes of the bill, public available data is data that is available in the public domain without restriction. Obviously, if there's one or other restriction that applies to that data will not qualify as public available data. Okay, clause 1.2 is on page 14. Okay, again, first rant that says data is broader than the scope of personal information. Yes, it is. On the other hand, it is not. Personal information is defined in the Popia, and that relates to information pertaining to an identifiable individual or legal person, and then provides an unlimited description of what is personal information. Data, on the other hand, is everything, and that relates to what Mr. Fonfran explained previously, information. Data in the context of cybercrime is anything, but the bill itself limits it, namely that it must be an article. An article is further defined as data that's involved, amongst others, in the commission of an offence. So yes, it's broader and wider, but again, the Popia and the bill is two different disciplines, and you cannot compare them. Maybe a more important comment is discussed on page 15 of the document that I did distribute. From the inception of the bill, there was always concerns from people that administrate the Protection of Personal Information Act on the one hand, and people on the other hand that deals with law enforcement pertaining to cybercrime. In terms of clause 1.2 of the bill, we did try to clarify the application of the Popia vis-à-vis the bill. The main concern of the Popia persons relate to Section 2 of the bill, that deals with unlawful access to, amongst others, data. So we did try to address it in that clause. I did also consult with Ananda Lowe from the South African Law Reform Commission. She was the person that actually compiled the Law Reform Commission report, and other people, and they did indicate that we must try to beef up this clause to make a clear delineation between when POPIA will be applicable and when the cyber bill will be applicable. In the future, when you deal with clause-by-clause deliberations of the bill, the department will propose an amendment to clause 1-2 and also to clause 2 to address this concern further. In short, the whole concern is that the current offence in section 2 criminalises unlawful intentional commission of an act that places a person in a position to access data. That can probably be construed as a contravention of the POPIA as well. So we try to come up with a solution that say, let's couple the whole offence first to where you perform an act in respect of a computer system, which then provides you access to data. That is also in line with the UK Computer Misuse Act, and it's section 487 of the Australian Criminal Code. So that is probably something in the future for the committee to consider. But again, I must say that cybercrime deals with cybercrimes, and POPIA deals with the protection of personal information. They cannot overlap. Okay, then on page 17 is chapter 2, part 1. I deal with cybercrimes. And in part 1 is the real cybercrimes that is committed and which is already part of our law and which has now been formalized in our law by means of the cybercrimes law. First, Rand on page 17 do not seem to understand a proscription or a criminalizing provision, and they say the bill determines that the person is guilty of offense, and we should insert a wording to the effect that the person is must be proved to be guilty before he can be convicted of an offence. Obviously, this is not a necessity. In all the legislation, there's criminalising provisions that sets out the definitional elements which must be complied with to deal with an offence. And obviously, there's a constitutional provision, section 35, that do provide everybody is innocent until proven guilty. It's really not necessary to address a comment like that. On page 18, clause 2, Mr. Richard Ryan, he refers to the word intentionally access a computer system. He do refer to instances where a person may negligently or by mistake access a computer system and then commit certain other offences. According to him, the intentional part of that offence may be a problem to address cybercrime. Our response there to is, if you look at most offences on the statute book, all offences is willful or intentional offences. Negligent offences is probably only negligent driving, nothing more. So intention must always be a part of any criminalising provision. Obviously, if you look at the different forms of intention in the South African law, like juris directus, indirectus, or juris eventualis, juris eventualis is to the effect that a person who commits an act, and if he foresees the possibility that a certain result may result, he can be held accountable. So it's an expanded form of intention, and that will most probably cater
for the scenario pointed out by Mr. Richard Ryan. He also referred to the current practices by many security companies on page 19 of the presentation, who actually mine the internet to see or to monitor username and passwords that were leaked, probably illegally, and they use that for statistical results or for measures to address unlawful access or other cybercrimes. My response there to is, if you merely use the internet and you do not perform an unauthorized function in respect of another computer system, it will not be an offense. Again, if it's public available data, and if they mine that data, no offense will result. So it's my submission, we don't need to address that. But that also relates to many other submissions that we did receive in the past, is where people refer to the so-called white hat hackers. That is people who actually hacked the justice database and then informed the justice administrator that your system has got flaws. That person do commit an offense. There's nothing about it. It's the same as a burglar that burglars your house and then afterwards inform you your computer system is not up to date. It's basically the same. It should be an offense. Freedom of religion, the specific reference to clause 2 and most definitely with unlawful access to data, I do refer to the fact that the constitutional right to freedom to expression is contemplated in section 16 of the Constitution, criminalized the conduct of whistleblowers and journalists. Okay, first, in summary, my submission is, even in whistleblower legislation, that doesn't authorize the whistleblower to commit the offense to obtain information which can then be made available. And most definitely, journalists is important in a democratic society. But again, the current legal position is that a journalist cannot commit an offense and then make that information available and to the extent that he cannot be prosecuted for such disclosure of information. I must say, I refer you to the current trend in South African law. You do get grounds of justification that relates to the unlawfulness of any conduct. In some instances, you may perform an act in necessity. That is where you act in, well, can help me in this instance, to protect a third person or the property of a third person. In instances like that, the courts may, in certain instances, regard an act to be lawful. And obviously, this may apply to people who may commit offences and then disclose certain information. But that is still for the courts to be recognized. I do explain it extensively on pages 19 to 21. Where I do refer to the relevant cases and everything and what's applicable. But I did summarize the gist of everything. Okay, first rant on page 21. Again, that refers to access and access to personal information that has been addressed. And like I indicated, we will propose the amendment to this clause. On page 21, clause 3. Clause 3 of the bill, amongst others, deal with the unlawful interception of communications stored in, that is transmitted to or from a computer system, including the electronic emissions from such a computer system. The concern that is raised by first rant on page 21 and 22 can probably be summarized as follows. According to them, if you look at section 3.2 and 3.3, 3.2 provides that
A person who is found in possession of information that is intercepted unlawfully is guilty of an offense. And the second one, in 3.3, the second offense provides that a person who is found in possession of data in which there is a reasonable suspicion that the data was intercepted unlawfully, and that person is unable to give an explanation as to his possession, is guilty of an offense. Firstly, the objection is raised that 3.3 is unconstitutional. My submission is you must look at the current offense on the statute book, section 36 of the General Law Amendment Act. And the General Law Amendment Act was already considered extensively in Osman and another versus the Attorney General versus Transvaal, where they did declare that type of offense to be constitutional. According to the Constitutional Court, it's mainly the inability to give a satisfactory explanation relating to the possession that is criminalized in that type of offenses. First round, this time freedom of religion also raised a similar objection also to section 3 or clause 3.2 and clause 3.3, according to them infringes on the constitutional right of freedom of expression since it criminalizes the conduct of whistleblowers and journalists. I think I already gave explanation that this can never be regarded as something that must be protected. For example, if I intercept the honorable lady next to me computer communications and I finish it to somebody else, that surely should be criminalized. And currently there's no exception in the law that will regard that action as lawful. It is unlawful. So, it does not infringe on section 16 of the Constitution. On page 23, first round recommends that electromagnetic emissions from a computer system should be defined. Electromagnetic emissions from a computer system is usually a frequency that's given off by a computer, or if data is transmitted over a fixed line, you can use the device and you can actually record it and reconstruct the data. So my submission, it's not necessary to define it for purposes of the bill. And the question is also asked whether location data will be included in the unlawful interception of data. Obviously, this will be included in this offense and also under the definition of data. Location data is more or less where the device is at the moment when it makes a communication. You can get that in relation to mobile cell phones with computers that access the web and certain virtual programs that is used at a specific time in a certain place. On page 24, and that again relates to clause 3, Vodacom requires that the bill must provide explanation of what is a satisfactory account of such possession. My submission is this is really not for the bill to deal with. This has been interpreted by the court over and over and over. I do refer, amongst others, to State v. Albee 2001, where this aspect is dealt with comprehensively. Okay, clause 4 of the bill deals with tools to commit certain offences. It criminalises the use of that tools in relation to the commission of certain offences. Anonymous, amongst others, do bring it to our attention, yes, that this tool is used by security experts and security audits. And Richard Ryan, on that same page, amongst others, referred to the fact that this tool is freely available. Our response thereto is yes, I know. We know that this tool is necessary for security audits and penetration testing. And the bill do allow for such an exemption. That is why the bill only in Clause 4 criminalized the use and possession of that tools if that tool is used to commit certain cyber offenses. Obviously, when a security audit is undertaken by a security expert, he will act within a mandate, usually a written authority by the person in charge of a computer system that will say, security expert, please do a pen testing exercise on my system to see if there's any vulnerabilities. If that security expert acts outside that authority, he do commit an offense. But otherwise, if he acts within that lawful authority, he doesn't commit an offense. Clause 5 deals with interference with data on a program. First round then refers to, again, to what happens if somebody in error interfere with data or a program. And our response there is, in terms of the bill, intentional conduct is required. And if a person in negligence interferes with data or a computer program, he will most probably not be prosecuted for an offense. In any case, before you can prosecute a person for any offense, there's a lot of requirements that must be complied with. Usually a person that in error perform any conduct does not comply with the definition elements of most offenses. Clause 6 is on page 25. MTN makes the following observation in respect of interference, namely that if you update certain systems in an ordinary course, obviously service providers must do it. According to their submission, it's unclear whether they commit an offense. My submission is no, they do not commit an offense. Obviously, if the system belongs to the electronic communication service provider, they can update their own systems. They can alter the resources thereof. But obviously, they've got a certain margin in which they can operate. In some instances, they may commit an offense if a system update also involves updating what's on my cell phone. In that instance, they will commit an offense. It depends on the authority. Look, this is a broad aspect, and I don't think it's really necessary to go to in detail in such instances. All services that is provided by a service provider is usually covered by contracts that runs into hundreds of pages. Even nowadays, if you look of take Firefox, before they do a system update or install a new version, they will ask you for a specific authority to do that. So there might be instances where it may be a crime and other instances where it may not be a crime, but ordinary system update is not a crime. Clause 7, that deals with making available of certain passwords, access codes and similar devices, and FirstRand requested us to define financial transaction. In clause 3.7, or rather paragraph 3.7, I refer to various legislation where the word financial transaction appears and where it has never been identified, so the expression must be interpreted in its ordinary meaning, and that's usually something like giving money in exchange for something else. Clause 10, cyber extortion, it's the Commission of General Gender Equality, that's at the bottom of page 25. And they requested that Clause 10 must be expanded to include extortion or blackmail through revenge pornography or distribution of non-consensual pornography or other intimate images. First, if you look at the schedule, if you look in the schedule to the bill, a clause 10A to the sexual offences is proposed. In terms of clause 10A3, there's a specific offence that deal with revenge pornography, where this is used for extortion. In any case, it can probably be also be prosecuted under clause 10 as extortion, and we don't really need to refer to pornography, since the current legal position do recognize a threat for consideration, which can be in the form of pornography as extortion. You can look at, amongst others, State v. J, a 1980 decision, and also the General Law Amendment Act of 1992, which is discussed below, and that clarifies what I just said. Okay, on page 26, clause 11, aggravated offences. Commission of Gender Equality wants to include various sexual offences as aggravated offences. Our submission is it is already criminalised by other provisions with enhanced punishments, and it's not necessary to include it in clause 11, 1 or 2 of the bill. An important aspect, however, is that of first rand, and that relates to clause 11.2, and that's on page 27, where they do refer to the aggravated offence in 11.2, which is committed in respect of essential service facility or system, or which result in a major economic loss. That this concept is actually undefined. To some extent, I do agree with that, and we will propose an amendment to clause 11.2 to narrow its application. On page 28, I must make an excuse due to the fact that I do refer in a response to clause 13, it's clause 12, on page 28, and that relates to instruction to court to recognize the theft of incorporeal property. And Center for Applied Legal Studies do request that certain sexual content, certain data messages that has sexual context and which is then stolen must be regarded as theft. My submission is it will be covered by the definition of theft. Obviously, it's a property that probably has commercial value, and if it is then stolen by another person, irrespective of whether it's in a corporal or incorporeal form, it will qualify as theft in terms of clause 12. That is more or less all the comments that we did receive in respect of the cyber crimes, and I can now proceed to the chapter dealing with malicious communications.
Madam Chair, honourable members, with your permission, I just want to say something short. I think Sarah has said it all, but, you know, on the question of definitions, we can all debate the definition until tonight midnight. But, and whilst you were speaking, I had a look at, for instance, the definition of unauthorised access in terms of Section 86 of ECTA, you know, the ECT Act. And I know for a fact that in textbooks that definition was criticized. But we must remember, and when this committee, honorable members, consider this criticism, we must remember the Constitution also makes provision for the fact that courts can take cognizance of developments in other countries and the court can develop a definition. And I'll give you a practical example. Brigadier Pieterse, who sat here, arrested a bank official who acted on behalf of a syndicate there in Southgate in Johannesburg. She accessed the bank accounts. And in court, the defense was, but I'm a bank official. I had access. So what? And then we cited American case law that says that if an employee breaches that duty of loyalty he owes, for instance, to his employer, in her case, FNB Bank, access, there's no access, even if they gave her access in the first place. So the courts bought that argument, and we had good judgments on this. You know, so a definition can be developed. It's not the end of the road if it's a poor definition. Thank you. That's all I wanted to say on that score.
Shall I proceed?
Sorry, Cyril. Initially you said you were going to present up to which point?
I will try to finish after malicious communications, but this is in the hands of the committee. We will come back at the later stage in any case to deal with everything else. I believe the police did give their presentation. It's probably not necessary for them to stay on, but it's up to the committee to decide.
Okay. I think we'll probably continue till 1 o'clock, and let's just see how far we get with that process. I think the SAPs would want to remain, at least for today, or the whole delegation. But Commissioner, I think if the Minister and yourself want to excuse yourself, we can take a 2-minute leg stretch. Okay, let's do that. We're taking a 2-minute leg stretch and we'll be back.
Thank you.